Turn to the book of Exodus. The Ten Commandments, you see them up behind us, a representation of them. I don't know how good your Aramaic is, but if it's very good, you can read them. The Ten Commandments, they are symbols. They are symbols of the rules of God. I know there are specific Ten Commandments, but they tend to be the front door to everything else that God has said. Now, most people, even people who are not religious, have some familiarity with the Ten Commandments. In fact, it's a pretty common thing to speak of those in any circle of life. Now, it's interesting that most people know they're really, really important and they really, really matter, but most people don't know what the Ten Commandments are. In fact, 25 senators in 2004 made an amendment basically to say, or proposed an amendment to basically say that the Ten Commandments should be posted everywhere, that everyone needed to know them. Well, some obnoxious media person, and I say this with a twinkle in my eye, gave the 25 senators a test and said, if they're so important, what are they? Of the 25 senators, one could name them. And the other 24 senators couldn't name more than three. That's kind of what happens to the Ten Commandments. Everybody knows they really matter. But what they actually are, we're not real sure. We know thou shalt not kill. That's one of them. And thou shalt not steal. That's one of them. And I'm not sure the right to bear arms is in there somewhere, I think. I think that's one of them somewhere in there. I mean, they sort of symbolize something, but their substance is pretty missing. And so we're going to try to spend a little time on their substance. I would say this. The Ten Commandments are certainly at the center, and they are the symbol of a false belief. You see, there's a false belief that exists in every religion, and it exists around the perimeters of Christianity as well. The false belief is, keep the rules, then you can have a relationship with God. Now, that's a constant in every religion. The basic belief is that we're not good. We kind of know that. But if we could just become good, God would accept us. And so it doesn't matter which God. Everybody kind of wants to know, according to which system, what are the rules? You just tell me the rules I need to live up to. And if I really want God to pay attention to my prayers and heal my daughter, I really want God to pay attention to my prayers and do this, well, maybe I can become gooder in His sight. And become gooder in His sight, I'll do these things. And maybe God will say to me, you're not so bad. I guess. Now, if you'd have come to me 3 weeks ago, I wouldn't let you in. But the last couple, 3 weeks, you've been doing better. I'll listen. That basic belief is pretty common. I'm indebted to Andy Stanley, some things that he wrote. And in this series, I want to make sure that I at least tell you up front that Andy Stanley needs to have some credit for a book that he's got that's been very helpful to me in this process. This is one of Andy Stanley's quotes, and he's right. The Ten Commandments are not the condition for a relationship with God. The Ten Commandments are a confirmation of a relationship. You have to start with that principle. Why does God give laws and rules? If you look at Christianity and you say, wow, it's just tons of laws and rules. Gee whiz, I can't imagine ever becoming a really committed, sold-out Christian because you just got all these rules and rules and rules and rules, and the Ten Commandments sort of start this whole thing. You got to challenge that first concept. Remember how the nation of Israel started? We talked about it last week. Josh introduced the idea. I did some of it at the door. The Ten Commandments are given to a people not who need to establish a relationship with God, but people who God had already accepted and they were already His. God gave the Ten Commandments to His people. Now, I'm going to make a political statement that some of you will be really fussy at. I have no interest in seeing the Ten Commandments posted on the interstates. I have no interest in seeing the Ten Commandments posted in the courthouses. Now, I understand we have a historical base in some matters, but I'm going to tell you right now, the Ten Commandments are never to be flyers handed out in the neighborhood going, if you want a relationship with God, this is where you start. Just keep these rules. Keep these. If you do that, you'll be fine. That's not true. The Ten Commandments are given to people already in a relationship. And the shock and wonder of the nation of Israel was, you start off going, you're our God. We didn't do anything. We don't even know the rules. We haven't kept anything. And His answer was, you trusted me. I came, I chose you in your broken condition, and you trusted me. I ask you to have a supper. I ask you to put the blood from that supper on the doorposts. And I accepted you. You were broken people who needed mercy. You're my people. The relationship is already established. Let me start with a silly little illustration. When did your dog become your dog? When you put it in your fence? When it was outside your fence, said, not my dog. But as soon as you took it in the gate and you closed the gate and said, okay, now you're in my fence, you're my dog. Which means then when your dog gets out of your fence, you go, not my dog, because my dog's in my fence. And if a dog's not in my fence, not my dog. Neighbors call and say, we have your dog. It's in our fence. And you said, must be your dog. Because if it's in your fence, it must be your dog. Because my dog's in my fence. The answer to that is no. No. It became your dog when you purchased that dog. And you brought it home and you put it in your fence. Why? Because the fence was your means of protection for the dog. In fact, it was some act of affection even to put that dog in your fence. And when that dog gets out of your fence, you don't say, that's not my dog. You go run and look everywhere, and you hunt everywhere you can look. I realize some things don't translate well when you're trying to say them to an audience, but last week, a week ago, I spent a lot of a morning hunting for my dog, the one you've heard me tell about, little Brittany Spaniel, little Springer Spaniel, sorry. This little Springer Spaniel had been with me a long time, and I know her routines, and they're down, and she's always in, and I couldn't find her. I found her before the day was over, and I had to put her down. I don't know which law she violated, but it was my dog. I don't know what she violated. I don't know if in the middle of the night she violated the law that says if the paper man comes up the driveway, don't let his bumper hit you. I don't know if that's the law. 3 or 4 nights before, we'd had people break into the cars, and her barking had driven them off. I don't know if she violated the law that says if they come back with baseball bats, you don't let them get too close to your ribs. I don't know what she violated. I don't know if she violated the law that says you don't get too close to a stranger who kicks your side in. I don't know what it was. But a dog that was always my walking buddy lost her life because she violated some laws. My backyard was never intended to be her trap. My laws were never intended to be my masochistic side coming out, my sadistic side. Everything I ever wanted to do with that little dog, the leash that I put on her before I put her in the truck when she was a pup, and I tied her. You tied me down? What a terrible man you are to tie me down. Because she learned to ride in the back of a truck where I knew she was safe. Oh, there came a time she was grown enough I could take the leash off in the back of the truck, but we had to start with the training wheels. She never did fully understand why the word heel mattered when I got close to the highway when we were walking, and why she could run everywhere, but I would holler heel, and she would come, and we always crossed the highway with her to heel. I don't know if she ever understood what that process was. I didn't give her a law to make her my dog. I gave her a law because she was my dog. Anybody who looks at anything that the Lord has to say and you say, wow, this is just a bunch of terrible rules, just meant to capture me in some form or fashion. Now, you don't understand. The concept of a relationship precedes anything else. That's why Josh could say last week that rules without a relationship always lead to rebellion. Relationship will always lead to rules because of affection. Your family, you have children, and you have the right to set the rules for your children. Why do you set those rules? Well, if your heart is good, I know what your rules are for. They're massive protection. And I can come to you and say, hey, I got some really neat rules for your kids. And you'd look at me and say, well, that's really nice. But no, you don't set the rules for my kids. I set the rules for my kids. These are my kids. God has all along said, you need to know, my rules are for my kids. And these are the things that I pass on in order to protect my kids. When I consider all the years of ministry that most of us in this leadership have been on, I can tell you one of the great heartbreaks you get on a consistent basis is manacled hearts and souls and spirits that have been captured. God gave his laws to the nation of Israel because he had just set them free from slavery and he wanted to keep them free. They had been set free from a nation that taught them false things and a nation that misabused them and a nation that mistreated them and a nation that, in fact, if you want to use the dog analogy a whole lot further than I probably ought to, they'd just been released from a bad master. And God sets them down and begins to give a new set of rules because he wants to keep them free. Those of us involved in ministry would say on a consistent basis that you begin to talk to a guy who got involved in pornography. He got involved in pornography to be a big boy, wears big boy pants. Nobody's going to tell me I'm a little boy. And I know what this stuff is. And it has a sense of empowerment. You don't have to be involved with people. But a couple of years of doing this and you realize it captures. And this guy who felt empowered and released and free because of pornography ends up being weak and fearful and isolated and scared and broken. He won't have legitimate relationships in his life. He'll always have. He is captured by sin. Every boy that ever slept with a girl that he wasn't married to, every girl that ever slept with a boy she wasn't married to becomes captured. He becomes especially captured by lust and she becomes captured by insecurity. Not an insecurity that she may wear out in the visual form, but an insecurity that I guarantee you, those of us who do marriage counseling, you go, no wonder God is crying out over and over again, don't commit adultery and the other things that will be in this. They are meant to liberate, not capture. God gives his laws to keep us free. Let's get into them just for a little bit this morning. The first commandment. The first commandment is in verses 1, 2, and 3. You don't even hardly notice that you even have a first verse because of how fast it goes. But here's the first one. It's just a summary of the relationship concept. That's all it really is. Exodus 20, verse 1. And God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God. I want you to notice the personal pronoun. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I want you to know of my great love and my affection and my redemption. I want you to know my purposes for you. I want you to know where I'm taking you. I'm taking you away from slavery. In fact, let me make an interesting little observation. Sometimes when you notice baptisms here, I think you probably have a tendency not to notice what's occurring. If you only notice a baptism, you missed it. Do you not understand that everybody who comes to Christ is having their own Exodus experience? It is, I'm coming out of a captivity and a life that was not right, and I am being set free. Every baptism is less about baptism and more about release than it is any other single thing. And so that's where he starts off. And therefore he moves into verse 3 and he says, and you shall have no other gods before me. He walks them down memory path and said, I've chosen you. And now you have to decide whether you want that relationship. Choose me. That's the corresponding deal. Do you want the relationship? It's interesting that he says this radical idea that I want you to choose me relationally as your only God. That's a pretty significant concept. It's radical. For thousands of years before that and for many, many years after that, there would always be a plurality of gods among every people. Why? Because if you believe in a false god, you always believe in a limited god. You need help with your crops. You better find a god who does that. You need help with the rain, the weather. You need a god who does that. You need help with your love life. You need a god who does that. You need help with having children. You need a god who does that. You need help with health so your daughter gets over her sickness. You need a god who will help you with that. And then you need help in your old age. What's going to happen when I die? So you had a plurality of gods. It's interesting. Jesus says, or God says in this text, you don't need all those limited false gods. All you need is me. I'll be your full service God. You need anything? You have no idea of my size and my wonder, my glory. You need help with your crops? You come to me. You need help with the weather? You come to me. You need help with your love life? You come to me. You need help with your children? You come to me. You need help with your old age and your dying? You come to me. I'm a full service God. And I want a relationship with you. Choose me. The concept, is God big enough, will be picked up in the next one as well. Exodus chapter 20, verses 4, 5, and 6. Your servant wants to see what's out there. Open his eyes. And the servant's eyes were open, and he saw that the mountains were full of the flaming chariots of the host of God. And I say it again. Don't you dare wreck anything that symbolizes me. I don't care where you slept last night. You woke up this morning in my presence. I don't care how far you ran yesterday, where you flew, what you did, what you drove. This morning you were in my presence, and you were no further from the core of my presence there than you are here. You'll go to bed tonight playing in front of the throne of God. Don't you dare minimize me. This concept of a smaller God is just not right. And yet, on the other hand, quite frankly, we find that a bit intrusive. A powerful God who's everywhere, who can't be represented by anything. Boy, I'd like to shrink him down into something more manageable. Let's make God to be about Sundays. And let's make God to be about church and music and candles and baptisms, so that we can come and be around God on Sundays, and we can be religious. And then on Mondays, we can not be religious. And we kind of got God back at the, I mean, he's in that place on Sunday. And on Friday night, we can be really not religious. I mean, we're a long way from that. But on Sundays, I can come back. And I came back, and here I am, my touchstone. I found you again. See, I wasn't too far away, God. I really wasn't. A backpack God. Ultimately, that's what our culture's sort of created, a backpack God. One you can strap on and feel secure when you want it, but it's one you can take off and set it down and stay. You're going to fly to Las Vegas. Boy, get your back. Flying's scary. I mean, there's terrorists and things die. You know, they blow up and you die in planes. I mean, I want my backpack God. But when you get to Las Vegas, here, you stay in this room. I'm going to close that door. You stay there. I'm back. I didn't go far. And you begin to have things that are front and center in your life. And you say to your backpack God, please bless these things that are front and center in my life. These are things, God, everybody, I believe everybody should have God in their life. And God, you're in mine, my backpack God. And here I'm going to unzip that, because I'm pretty worried about this thing right in my life, my job, my health, the thing that's front and center. Here, could you get out of that backpack and fix this for me? Because I'm pretty scared about that. Thank you, God. That's, appreciate that. Now let me zip that back a little bit. I'll get back with you when I need you. And all of this whole text is about minimizing and stuffing down and reducing the God who is. It's an incredible passage. The first two commandments are basically these. Will you choose me? I've chosen you. And the second is, will you put me at the center of your life everywhere you go, everything you do? You won't restrict me to 4311 Newman Road. You won't tie me to something stupid like Randy standing there in some kind of a jacket with a tie on. Don't tie me to that, please. You won't tie me, will you, to the edges of your life. You'll make nothing to represent me. It's just me. Quite frankly, if we understood the first two commandments and really got it, you wouldn't need anything else. You wouldn't need to be told, don't kill, don't steal. Well, why would I? I'm in the middle of the presence of God, a God who I trust and a God who loves me and a God who's trying to protect me. Why would I ever do these things? It's the failure to comprehend the first two that get everything else. Let's finish just a little bit in the last couple of minutes we have. He gives a warning. His warning is in verse 5. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I am the Lord your God. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Wow, I don't want you to do with verse 5. Oh, I recognize there's a part of me that really doesn't like verse 5. He's a jealous God. Now, let me remind you very, very quickly, you better not define jealousy by the terms you want. You better define the word jealousy by the biblical terms. Here's what I probably would begin with, is he says, I'm a protective God. I'm protective of the truth, and I won't let you live a lie. You try to live a lie, I am a jealous God for the truth. I won't join in your lie. I remember back in eighth grade, we had one of the worst science teachers on the face of the earth. I have to be careful that I don't let the name slip out because I'm sure that there's people around. But I'm telling you, in all my years of teaching, I never had a worse teacher ever. We set fires and trash cans and all that. I mean, we did everything under the sun imaginable to this poor guy, and he had no clue. He thought, probably to this day, thinks he has the worst class he ever had when he was taught eighth grade. But this guy was terrible. But one of the things he was most terrible on is he paid no attention to cheating. And so somebody would start, it just passed down the rows. It wasn't hidden. It was just take a piece of paper, look at it, and go, okay, and fill in what you wanted. I mean, that was what the class did. Do you know how incredibly refreshing it was when there were individuals you went to pass it to, and they simply wouldn't take the piece of paper? If you want to cheat, you're going to not do it with my help. You're going to have to get up and walk around me. I'm not passing it. You don't have to read off of it. Just pass it. I'm not passing it. I'm not touching it. You want to do it, you're going to do it without my help. God says I'm a jealous God for the truth. You want to live a lie, don't expect me to partner with you on it. I'm a jealous God for the truth. I'm also jealous for you. I care for you enough, I will fight and defend for you. I'm jealous for my wife. Julie was supposed to fly back last night from Indianapolis area, where she was speaking at a conference, and flights got canceled. So she got hung up in the middle of the deal. They told her they couldn't fly her out till tomorrow. I don't know where Julie is. They were going to fly her out of Indy to Dallas and try to get her back through Dallas. I don't know what I've been calling all morning. I'm picking her cell phone. I care where my wife is this morning. Even before I came in here, I slipped out and I wanted to know where Julie was in this process of bouncing from airport to airport. I care. Don't you misinterpret any of this. I'm a jealous God. I care for you. And I'm not going to let you be stolen by false gods and false ideas without my fighting for you. And I'm not only jealous for the truth, I'm not only jealous for you, I'm jealous for others. If you try to use your life to wreck other people, I will war with you. You use your life to wreck other people, I will war with you. I will pursue you and chase you, but when you reject me enough that you want no relationship, I will try to protect others from you. There are individuals in this room I'm pretty confident God's at war with. Because your rejection of a relationship with a living God has made you damaging to other people. Now, the part I don't understand is when he says to the third and fourth generation. I don't know that. I don't understand that. I do know this. I watched through all biblical history that whenever any person wants to turn around from a wicked family, God allows, even from a wicked family, great repentance and wonderful blessings in their life. So I don't know how to match all this. I don't know about generational punishment, but I do know about generational consequences. Here's what he says: you try to live without me at the center of your life, and even your grandchildren will suffer the consequences of what you chose. I don't think it's sort of the Lord's punishment. I think it's just generational consequences. As I was working on this sermon, I went back and looked at my grandfathers. And they're men I love, and so there's no trying to slap in this. But I wondered what it would be like in Ronnie and Donnie and Jerry's life. I wondered what would have been the case with Raymond's life. I wonder what would have been the case with, and I can run down this, what would have been different in my life if my grandfather Arthur had, I wished I knew. Generational consequences. By the way, whatever you think about generational consequences, notice what he says, verse 6. But I will show love to 1,000 generations of those who love me. You want to know the consequences of putting God center in your life? Let me finish with this. Praise team, you can come on out. You have to decide whether God's center in your life, because if he's not center, wherever you get up in the morning and the first thing you say is, I'm yours, God, today, the answer is yes. I don't care what you ask, where you sin, what you do, the answer is yes. I trust you. We're in a relationship, and every one of your rules are meant to be training wheels until my own heart begins to understand it and catch it. The answer is yes. Whatever you say, God, the answer is yes. Yes. You have to teach me, God. You have to empower me. You have to strengthen me, God. You have to use other people. But God, the answer is yes. If that's not what you're doing, then you've put a little G there. I mean, if you didn't put capital G, God, then you've got a little G. Your backpack, God, over here. God, I'm going to take you to work on the drive, and so please know I'll need you. But my little G is first. Megan and myself and Allison Snell went for a little supper last night. We were sitting there. Megan just talked through. She said there was just chapters in her life, and she talked about what the little G in her life was. Having to do with how people perceived her, and she thought about it, and having to do with what her own, and she said, I had God, but the little G, and that was our conversation. Who are you? Psalm 115 and Psalm 116, I'll just have him put him on the screen behind me. Psalm 115 is this passage that says the idols, not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name be the glory, because of your love and faithfulness. Why do the nations say, where is their God? Our God is heaven. He does whatever pleases him. Their gods are silver and gold made by the hands of men. And the rest of the text says they have mouths, but they can't speak. They have hands. They have feet, but they can't move. Notice the very next psalm, Psalm 116. In Psalm 116, he writes, I love the Lord, for he heard my voice. He heard my cry for mercy. Because he turned his ear to me, I will call upon him as long as I live. I want to be the Lord's. I want a capital G, and I want to read the Ten Commandments and other passages because they are the Lord's protection in my life. Obviously, the Old Testament's still the training wheels. When I come to the New Testament, I begin to have God fleshed out and some of the training wheels come off. But it never changes. God in the center. This morning, if that's not the case with you, why would you walk out of here with a backpack God? We'd like to talk to you about that. Would you stand and respond? If you'd like to talk to a minister, we'll be down front. Membership or anything else, we'd love to talk to you. Would you respond?